Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. Lynn here in Colorado, Bruce in Oregon. So he's been back and forth, and he used to live in Colorado, but now he's an hour earlier. So good morning, Bruce. What's going on with you today?
I'm just enjoying the morning, and it's been mostly sunny here, but it's a little overcast this morning, but enjoying the spring foliage and color and all that good stuff. And how about you?
Oh, great. It's wonderful.
I understand there's been a little snow in snow in the Denver area in the last few days.
Yes. Snow, hail, wind, rain, everything. So you missed a good one, Bruce.
Well, it's all part of the dream of differences.
It is, absolutely, absolutely. It's hilarious. So, so Bruce has suggested that we look at this FACIM outreach, which I did post in the room, and it looks like a really good one today, Bruce. I mean, this is really good, all of them, but this one I think really gets to the heart of a lot of questions and a lot of answers that people have a difficult time understanding. So I'm really excited about this. But anyway, what's going on in Bruce world other than having beautiful springtime weather in Oregon? Anything, any new interviews or anything you're doing?
A bunch, actually. Yeah. In fact, this week I had an interview this last week or so, I guess. I've had an interview with Susan Dugan. We talked about what does it mean to accept the atonement for myself. And all these are posted on ACIM blog. That was a video conversation. Another video conversation, which is a third in a series of conversations with Dr. Bob Robert Rosenthal of the Foundation for Inner Peace. And we had sort of a part two of our conversation about his book, From Plagues to Miracles, which is excellent if you haven't already checked it out. It's the story of Exodus as a symbolic metaphor for our journey from ego to Holy Spirit, and with Moses being sort of the Holy Spirit archetype, if you will, that part of us that responds to those promptings anyway. And anyway, fun discussion. And then I had another conversation, an ongoing series with Jackie Laura Jones, who is the sister-in-law of Gary Renard. Cindy Laura Renard's sister. So we had a nice conversation about finding purpose in life. And let's see, I guess that's most of the new ones in the last week or so.
That's awesome. And Bob Rosenthal is going to be a speaker at the next ACIM conference in San Francisco in February.
I believe that's true. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. Which is huge. This is a huge thing to me, Bruce, because as you kind of know, we're kind of between two worlds here. And there's a world that the Foundation for Inner Peace, the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, Beverly Hutchinson, you know, Ken Wapnick, all that kind of stuff. That's all kind of one, I hate to say it, I call it the grown-up world of A Course in Miracles. That's terrible. I know that sounds really mean. And why would it sound mean for me to call that the grown-up world? Because the level of maturity in the course is there is a variation, there is a difference in this world. And so then a lot of other course teachers and students, you know, have a lot of workshops and et cetera, conferences, et cetera. This conference is one that I have not called the grown-up conference, even though I love the conference and it's a great thing and lots of great teachers are there. And, it's terrific. I mean, hundreds of people come to these conferences. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, the
You're referring to the Community Miracle Center conferences that are,
yes,
that are based in San Francisco. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I've been to two in San Francisco and then the most recent one in Las Vegas. And in fact, I think I saw you there.
Yes, least, I think you
at least
did.
I had a dream of seeing you there.
Yes, you did. You saw me there. And I'm going to be there in February 2018 as a speaker with David Fishman, Dom.
Yes.
And
yeah,
I are co-presenters. But for Bob Rosenthal to be invited to that, there has been a, I don't know if you call it literally a feud, but I would call it a feud, and between the Community Miracle Center philosophy and teaching of A Course in Miracles and the foundation. And so it sounds like it doesn't make sense. It's impossible. But, and yet there are variations in understanding and belief about A Course in Miracles. And so, you know, on the one hand, we have the idea that, you know, Jesus, not that Jesus wanted us to form a church and to make ministers and give people ordination and all that kind of stuff with the Course. But there are people who believe that that's a cool thing, and there's people who believe that that's not such a cool thing. And the differences between how we practice and
are we talking what the People's Front of Judea versus the Judean People's Front again?
Exactly. Exactly. Bruce, that's exactly it. And so there's been this feud. And as you may recall, if you were at the conference in New York.
I was not.
You were not at that conference.
No.
That was the big mind blower for me, because that is where Reverend Tony Ponticello got up and pretty basically called the whole Helen, Bill, Ken, and the foundation all a bunch of liars. And said,
I seem to have heard repercussions from that, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's been, I mean, that's radical. Yeah. That's radical to stand up in front of 300 or 400 people and tell them that, you know, you think that the entire founders of A Course in Miracles are crooks and liars. You know, that's a that's a pretty startling thing to hear and do. Like I said, this attempt between Reverend Tony and, you know, he's went to had lunch up there with them and with Bob and Judy, and invited Bob to come speak at the conference. And so I'm just excited because
I think there's a lot of healing going along on what we'd call the level of form.
Exactly.
And I'm reminded of that phrase, you know, the holiest place on earth is where an ancient hatred has become a present love, you know, and I think that, you know, that's true for any situation and any set of seeming individuals, because when we heal our individuality by finding the sameness that leads to the oneness, that's where we're recognizing that all those differences, we all make such big deals out of those. And we, you know, our culture praises our ability to discern the fine nuances between, you know, one thing and another thing, you know,
right,
because that's the whole foundation of the ego's thought system. So the ego is completely threatened by anything that appears to be different. So if it's the difference between the rough drafts of a spiritual masterpiece and the final published version, you know, the content's the same, but you know, the holy war factor can get pretty silly when we look at it, can't it?
It is pretty silly, and it's ridiculous. And what was so ridiculous about that whole, to me, the whole situation was that the title of the conference in New York was The Holiest Place on Earth.
Uh-huh. So. Well, oftentimes the very setting in which we have those healings is because we've give focus to the conflict. And I think that's why a great example, actually, really, I mean, of how it's really our mind, and we don't have to do anything. All we have to do is just pay attention and watch without condemnation the shenanigans of everyone's egos, including our own, and just say, wow, how silly is that? And then if we're willing to look at that from above the battleground, eventually we will see the absurdity of it and remove our identification from that conflict. And it's that removal of identification where the self that we think we are is no longer invested in particular outcomes of you know, religious wars or whatever we want to call any kind of turf battle in the mind, and that's the only place it can really happen. And then we have the opportunity to see peace instead of those differences. And I think that's, you know, where the real healing happens, isn't it? I mean,
it is absolutely. That's absolutely where the real healing happens. And actually, it doesn't happen unless something brings it to our mind. And points it out to us that there's something that seems to have gone wrong. And, so, you know, it's those, the things that we try to move away from, that we try to avoid and resist and not engage in, all those kinds of things that appear to be painful to us. And that's basically what it is, very painful, to be in conflict. Conflict is not pleasant. And
no,
so whenever
no.
you're in that kind of conflict, whether you are aware of it or not, you may think, oh, yeah, I'm winning. You know, I'm having a great time, you know, because, you know, I'm just showing those guys, you know, I know what I'm doing, or I'm the best, or, you know, I've got the right way. Or you may have all these ideas in your mind that you're doing great. But if you're in conflict with your brother over any part of it, then it's not real and it's not whole and it's not, and it is going to hurt you. It can and will hurt you, as the Course says.
Yeah, exactly. As you're sharing that, I was looking for, based on what we were talking about a moment ago, a line in today's workbook lesson for those doing it on a calendar basis. And this one struck me a few minutes ago when I was reading this. It says, we will succeed to the extent to which we realize there can never be a meaningful distinction made between what is untrue and equally untrue. I think that's the, you know, that people's front of Judea and Judean people's front, you know, distinction again. And anything that we make a big deal about on the level of form is fair game and fair, you know, certainly classroom fodder that is gently asking for our uncondemning awareness to be put on the altar of the mind and healed. And that's an amazingly gracious offering that we have. And we can afford to be grateful for all those things when they come up, and grateful to the seeming actors and actresses that bring them to our attention. And whether it's a presidential figure or a political party or a nation or a media, a pundit it could be anything or anyone. You know, there's somebody cutting you off in traffic. It could be a family member. It could be a coworker or somebody you meet shopping or in some other context. It doesn't matter. It's anything that, you know, raises the hackles on the back of your neck or provokes the least minor irritation or upset is exactly what we need to bring to the altar of our mind and say, okay, this is some projection I've made that is apparently part of the dream that I have hurled out of my mind in an attempt to escape from unconscious guilt, and worthy of my generous attention to not make a big deal about it, but just look at it, see it for what it is, and gently move on without any kind of condemnation or repercussions. And that's a real freedom, isn't it?
It is a real freedom. And as you were saying that, I was thinking, not only, you know, gently move on, but actually kind of get a little bit of a chuckle out of how silly it was to get involved in it or to fall prey to this insane story. So Pretty crazy. And you bring up some really great points this morning. So, and welcome dances. Good morning, sweetheart. Okay, so anyway, this next year, hopefully you'll be coming to that conference.
I've got it on my calendar. I haven't signed up for it yet, but
I think that's also
the one in July too in Utah that is where Bob Rosenthal and Tam Morgan and I believe Carol Howe and John Mundy and Gary and Cindy Renard.
And again, that's a David Hofmeister thing, right? David Hofmeister is so concerned about what's happening with the foundation. He really wants to shore it up, and because he understands the value of the translations.
Oh, absolutely.
For one thing.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the hugest value. I don't care who publishes A Course in Miracles.
It's in 27 languages now, which is kind of amazing.
You know, that's the amazing thing is the translations are so, so very helpful.
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, you know, my friend, Anna Daniela, who I met at a oneness thing, and she became fascinated with A Course in Miracles. And I had Teddy send her a copy of the Sparkling, and then she sent me a message and said, is it possible that you could get me this in Spanish? And I said, of course.
I actually have been meeting weekly with a team in Colombia that is working on the Spanish website, and just wonderful folks, and they're completely dedicated to you know, sharing the information in a way that is truly helpful, and just, you know, a wonderful group there in South America, putting together a companion website for Foundation Printer Peace. It's kind of a pilot program to have a website that is essentially mirrors the content of the new site that we're putting together for the Foundation Printer Peace. And so, yeah, it's fun to see that all coming together. Just a whole, I mean, I could go into much greater detail on all the goings on in that realm, but I won't bog a conversation down because it's sort of academic, I suppose.
Yeah, but it's good news, and it's good to hear because, you know, first off, because South America is hugely untapped as far as even the oneness community is huge in South America. You know, there are people who are clamoring for the truth, and
sure. So everywhere. I mean,
everywhere. that's true. Everywhere. Yeah. But you know, this is a huge thing to be able to make this available to people who, you know, may not otherwise be able to understand A Course in Miracles. And you know, not that I'm into going out and proselytizing the course.
Right, exactly.
It's not necessary.
Crossed my mind just as you said that. Exactly. It's not. There's nothing that we need do.
No.
As the Course says, I need do nothing. But if we're guided to share in a way that feels comfortable and isn't essentially going against the Course's prime directive of as Jesus says, you know, if I were to intervene in your thinking, I would be violating the most basic law that is, that the law of cause and effect. And everybody comes to whatever form of this universal curriculum that they need in their own time and in their own way. And all we need to do is just, you know, get the heck out of the way and follow our guidance and accept the atonement for ourselves. And that's sufficient. It's more than enough.
It is. And today's lesson and yesterday's lesson, these lessons are all about, you know, what the ramifications of that is.
Mm-hmm.
Because like today's lesson, only salvation can be said to cure. That this whole idea is so foreign to people, because they think, you know, he's talking about spiritualism or like Christian Science, science of mind. You know, it's not that. The cure that is actually given to us through the acceptance of the atonement is all the cure we need. You know, that it's,
yeah.
It fixes everything. And that's why, it doesn't matter. You know, he says, lay aside our amulets, our charms and medicines, our chants and bits of magic in whatever form they take. Lay that aside and listen for the voice for healing, which will cure all ills as one, restoring saneness to the Son of God. So the idea that all sickness comes from insanity and that insanity can be cured by accepting the atonement, by allowing the Holy Spirit to correct my thinking, correct my perception, and, you know, give me true knowledge. That's, you know, it said back in, I think, lesson 135, that one of the things that is not really pointed out so much because, you know, there's so much in lesson 135.
Oh, yeah. all the 130s, that whole, you know, about 10 of them in a row, just like super packed with incredible stuff this last week or so. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So in paragraph 8 of lesson 135, and I'm going to post it okay. here for you. Let's see. Where's my little chat window?
Oh, I've got it here. I just changed the 140 to 135 in my URL, okay. And I find it real quick that way.
All right. I just posted it in there. So in the window for you, I think.
Okay. But by the way, when the new website is launched, which hopefully won't be too much longer, if you bookmark, you know, one of the calendar daily lessons, you know, like daily lesson equals 135, it'll automatically go to the new page on the new site. So all these, I've got over 1,000 redirects from the old site to the new site. So it'll just magically take you to the appropriate page on the new site when we launch.
Oh, that's wonderful, Bruce. I appreciate that so much. This is going to, I'm excited. So, paragraph 8 of lesson 135, and I'm not trying to go backwards here, but it says the self that needs protection is not real. Mm-hmm. The body, valueless and hardly worth the least defense, need merely be perceived as quite apart from you, and it becomes a healthy, serviceable instrument through which the mind can operate until its usefulness is over. Who would want to keep it when its usefulness is done?
Mm-hmm. So recycle the package, you know. Just put your foot on the little pedal on the bottom of the recycle bin, have the lid pop up and drop the thing in there, you know.
Yeah. It's useless. Excuse me. But once, it's protesting. Hey, I'm not useless. I can make you pop.
<You're really
laughs> I can do anything to you.
Exactly. We all get blindsided sometimes when we forget to anticipate the ego's backlash, don't we?
I know, it's hilarious. Oh my gosh. But what he's saying here is just so amazing, because he's saying that all you have to do is perceive that your body is not what you are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All you have to do is perceive that this is not what I am.
Yeah.
And exactly. It becomes completely serviceable, healthy.
It's how can an illusion that is non-existent be anything but benign seen from that perspective, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what Jesus did.
Yeah. And I think a lesson, give or take one or two from this, it might be 132 or 3, you know, says, you know, there is no world, the central thought the Course attempts to teach. So if there's no world, then, you know, by inference, or deduction or logic or whatever, bodies kind of fall into that category. And so if that's the case, then, you know, again, this is all from the perspective of truth, from the idea of a mind that is aware of only what doesn't change. And I think that's the curriculum that we're studying here. You know, doesn't say to deny or ignore the photons and the auditory waves that enter your ear canals and the smells that enter your nose and all that, and taste that enter, that impinge on your taste buds. You know, say that those don't exist on the level of that experience. But it just says, you know, just question the reality of those as your identity. It's just basically saying, if you can just remember to take this entire cosmology with a grain of salt, in fact, being not even as big in truth as a grain of salt, because our real identity is bigger than the universe, and each one of us really is, as one being, greater and dwarfs what we call the cosmos, you know. So, because the reality that the Course in Miracles and any you know true pure non-dual metaphysical system that's worth its salt is sharing is that there is a reality that we all share that couldn't possibly be damaged or affected by anything that happens in a dream, and anything that changes has to be a dream. So
exactly, and yet you would be not surprised, I'm sure, by how many people read things like this in the Course and read things, so many things in the Course, and believe that what Jesus is saying is literal.
Right.
And that now, you know, once you just do this, that you're going to have like Bruce Jenner at the Olympics kind of health. Uh-huh. And you're suddenly going to become, you know, younger and healthier and everything is, your body's going to be perfect and you're never going to get sick. And this is why so many people said, well, you know, Ken Wapnick must not have made it because look, he had cancer, or Ramana Maharshi, or Nisargadatta, you know, because they're looking at this as a standard and saying, oh, well, if you are doing this and you are in perfect health. But Jesus doesn't say anything about his standard of health. Right. What he's saying is it's serviceable.
Yeah. And I think the irony and the beauty of what you just said is that you know, teachers like Ken and Nisargadatta and Ramana Maharshi and those kind of folks that, you know, we hold up to as and revere as emissaries of you know, very pure teaching of this non-dual tradition, themselves, I'll use Ken as an example, have said things like, you know, you have to read A Course in Miracles, reminding, you know, you can't stray too far from the metaphysics. You have to keep in mind that it's about always and only about the mind, and that you want to read it as you read an epic poem or listen to a great symphony, and that it's metaphor because we are the metaphor. So we have to, because we think we are, you know, these actual beings, these made up things, we have to, you know, be willing to look at the metaphoric language that is used in the Course, like, you know, God weeps for our return, and God doesn't have tear ducts, and if that isn't an obvious clue that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, poetic and metaphoric language in the Course, and then Jesus as, again, as also as a metaphor, you know, because it's a name that we can relate to, because we think there was actually this guy who traipsed around the Middle East a couple thousand years ago, and because there's a religion, formal religion based on things that he evidently said as a human, you know, we make a huge big deal out of that specific, and, you know, we take form and enshrine it at the expense of the content of what was actually shared. And the content is garbled and distorted and deleted and pretty much made a mishmash, of what was originally there. But even still, a lot of it gets through, you know. I mean, despite the ego's best attempts to obfuscate and distort and deny, you know, it's kind of amazing, isn't it?
It is really amazing. I'm sorry, I muted myself because I was coughing.
Yeah, and I do that too.
Yeah, it's this spring, wet spring. So, but yeah, exactly. So, so you know what he's talking about here is not that the body is, because basically, if you really believed that, then you would think that, you know, the body will never die, or the body will only die when I'm ready to drop it, which is the case. It's true, and yet. There's many things that could be happening. And it is all because of this dream that we believe is true. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
And so, that's what this lesson 140 is all about, is this dream, that we're sick.
Uh-huh.
And the only thing that is going to cure the dream of sickness is to awaken. You know, basically that's it. And the only way to awaken is to allow our minds to be corrected by the Holy Spirit and accepting the atonement. Mm-hmm. So, really, that's all we have to do is, you know, give up our thoughts, our mind, our will, our desire, for whatever in the world. Recognize that nothing here in this world, as you were saying from lesson 132, the whole idea is that the world is not true. And the whole idea is that understanding or knowing that is one thing, but experiencing it is something different. And so this is what he's given us opportunity in these lessons, is to experience the unreality of the dream, to experience the reality of ourselves. Mm. And these things do come about when we practice what he tells us. It is a cool thing. I don't know if people don't understand that or don't get it, but if people aren't coming from these lessons going, holy crap, I had an experience, and then, you know, I'm saying maybe you're not really doing the lesson, and not to feel guilty about it, but just understand that this is a whole thing. This is something that is extended into every part of your life. You can't do this lesson and then yell at the garbage man because he forgot to pick up your second can or something. You know, you can't do these lessons and look at, you know, Donald Trump and say, you know, what an evil jerk, and, you know, I hope he dies. You know, you can't do these lessons, and this is where I fall into all kinds of crap, because I think I'm doing these lessons, I think I'm doing this stuff, and yet any opportunity that I have to criticize my brother or to judge a situation or judge the people in the situation or any, I jump right into it and I do it. You know, that is, you know, clear to me that I'm not doing what Jesus is asking me to do. although I'm making a good attempt, I think, but, you know, just understand that, you know, these things will bring about an experience, because when I decide that instead of criticizing and cursing my brother, that I want to uplift my brother, appreciate my brother, know that he is the Christ, not pay attention to the clone, the puppet, but just know that the Christ is in all of us, is the same. And actually even looking at my brother and seeing him in a situation that is quite painful.
Exactly. And I think when we, you know, look at our condemnations and judgments, you know, let's use, you know, a current political situation as a metaphor. If we can remember that our inner kindness teacher, aka Jesus, aka Holy Spirit, of course, has always, from the beginning of the tiny mad idea, impeached, shall we say, the ego, then there was no offense, we can, on the level of form, we can watch all the shenanigans happening and recognize that the calls for love sometimes are off the charts, but that's all they are. And on the level of form, it might be the very best thing to have certain political figures removed from office. But in our mind, if we can recognize that there's complete innocence in truth of the essence of each participant in this play, in this psychodrama that's taking place in our minds as a part of the projection classroom that we're all experiencing. I'm suggesting maybe everyone listening might be, you know, have access to just about any kind of news media. You know, it's what a great opportunity to look at the contents of our unconscious mind on a silver platter and say, wow, here is a lack of love that has taken the form of, you know, characters in my mind that are calling out for love in a way that appears to be incredibly dysfunctional, but in a sense no more dysfunctional than any other dysfunction in truth. And I think that if we, you know, stub our toe or you know, misplace something in the kitchen and get upset for even a split second, that's no different than, in truth, now this is going to sound outlandish, but in truth, than hitting the red button in the Oval Office and starting a thermonuclear war. You know, holocausts and hangnails are really just, again, part of the same spectrum of illusion. And I think that's why these thoughts, we have such resistance to them. You know, in other words, I'll read a quote from Lesson 140 again that ties into that again. For how can one illusion differ from another but in attributes that have no substance, no reality, no core, and nothing that is truly different? Well, if the illusion is all the same, and a dream is all the same, from the perspective of truth, then from the perspective of what we truly are, there is no difference between us, between any petty tyrant and any revered saint. They're all projections of a dreaming mind, and from that perspective, all deserving of our love and compassion. Now, that's on the level of mind. On the level of behavior, it's probably a good idea to let the saints have more free rein and the corrupt politicians be taken out of office and perhaps incarcerated or whatever, you know. But those are different realms, and I think that's where the level of confusion is addressed nicely by teachers like Ken and you know how he says, you know, you have to look at the level that it's pitched at and remember that it's always and only about the mind. And when we do that, we will also look at our resistance and see that the resistance we have. For example, you know, this morning I was holding my phone in the air, just, you know, barely awake several times. And you know, I realized that I wanted to get up and do this show with you weekly. And so I wanted to read the lesson. So I had it kind of in my mind. And I was noticing the resistance I had, which was taking the form of a little grogginess and having to read one of those paragraphs three or four times before I realized, oh, I guess I'm awake enough, and letting it sink in. But the letting it sink in and applying it and throughout the day, the people who can do that are, in my estimation, you know, close to the graduation, because I find my resistance to it enormous, and I've been doing this for 30 years. But it doesn't mean that we're not making progress. It just means that I think we notice the resistance more and more and more, and see that that's not what we want, and then eventually it's sort of like a avalanche effect. Is I think that's when God takes the final step, is when we realize, wow, there really is nothing left in the world that I want to value, and there's really nothing left in the ego's propaganda bag of tricks that has appeal for me, that is seductive still.
Exactly. And it's making that decision and seeing over and over and over again that every time I make any other decision, I'm disappointed, upset, and in fear. And and I think about when you were talking about these political figures, and I'm thinking about, what would Jesus have done? And of course, Jesus was involved with political figures who were narcissists, who were, there at the end, who were, probably would have done the same thing. You know, I can just imagine, Pontius Pilate saying, "You're fired," and not, I'm not making an unpleasant, analogy here, but, and I could see what Jesus would say to that. And go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, he might have lost his pilot's license, right?
I knew there had to be a pun coming in there. but Jesus's reaction to this political figure who was, powerful and could order his death, mm-hmm, was not one of, "Oh, gee, I'm so sorry, please forgive me and make sure that, please don't kill me." Jesus wasn't saying any of those kind of things. And, how can we be like Jesus and be looking around at these political characters and be saying, "Well, you're bad and you're bad and you're bad and you should die, and I wish you, lived on Mars," or whatever kind of things we might be thinking toward those people. And, that's all gentle stuff. You should die or move to Mars. But,
that's gentle stuff. Okay. Well, then that brings up the idea that, that there aren't any, well, which we've been talking about, there aren't any orders of difference in magnitude or in, yes, in the dream, right? Anyway, exactly. I think I interrupted your thought. I apologize.
No. That's perfect. Yep. That's perfect, yep, because it's true. And so what Jesus would have done with any of these fellows was basically, you know, give them a blessing or whatever, you know, just being in his position, not begging and crying for his life. And yet, you know, that's how we see ourselves, or that's how I see myself looking at this, you know, this mockery of government. And, you know, I'm like, oh my God, national security. Oh my God, you know, you're giving away secrets. Oh my God. You know, I mean, I'm going into this panic mode of thinking, you know, this person has power over me. This person has power over my life. And, you know, the reality of it is I'm under no laws but God's. And if I don't remember that, if I keep forgetting that, then I'm going to keep falling into this panic mode about what's going on with the world, the economy, the environment, you know, whatever, politics, children starving, all that crap. But, you know, I'm not in control of any of those things. Those, you know, that's my business, and the only business I have is to accept the atonement for myself.
Exactly.
And accept the correction. And that correction of my mind is what then does give me the power to change things, not to change things in the world. Because, you know, why would I want to take away your valuable lesson by interfering in your experience? You know, and God doesn't even do that. God doesn't interfere with us. And that you were just saying that earlier, you know, that he's not going to come in and rescue us from our misery, because he doesn't recognize that it is misery. He doesn't see it that way in any way at all. And so, you know, this idea that, somehow I have the ability to rescue you from your misery, you know, and save you from the things I perceive as being bad, which you have already chosen for your experience in the world. It's not my business.
Exactly. Again, another good example, I think that I think might have been either Ken or Ken Wapnick or Gary Renard has probably both of them have in different ways, have used this metaphor of, you know, if you find a family member that's sleeping and having a nightmare and you hear them, you know, saying things or uttering things in their sleep that's, you know, clearly indicative of a nightmare, the kindest thing to do isn't to reach over and grab them and shake them. You know, that's not going to help. But, and say, why don't you wake up? But if you could maybe just hold their hand slowly and gently and say, whisper, this is a dream. You know, you're just dreaming. It's okay. And in a reassuring way. And I think that's the admonition that the Course makes for all of us is to just look at the bluster that ego musters, to make a little rhyme there, and realize that whether it's a physical illness or a political illness or an economic illness or, you know, all the forms that, the myriad forms that, you know, this dream seems to take as you know, plagues, to tie into Bob Rosenthal's book again, you know, that all those things are just ways of rooting us in the Pharaoh's ego's realm of thinking that we're enslaved and by form, and nothing could be further from the truth, but that's not how we see ourselves most of the time. So it takes a lot,
exactly,
of practice and a lot of patience with ourselves and everyone.
Yeah. Patience and trust.
Yeah,
that it's all going to be exactly as it is.
Yep, and that's what Jackie, Laura Jones, and I are starting a. Whether or not we take all 6 weeks, but we just got through the first stage in the development of trust yesterday in the Manual for Teachers. So we're going to go through those. So there's a lot in there.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Nuke Sanchez and Tomas Vera wrote a really neat book about that. Called Take Me to Truth, that is largely based on just those six stages in the development of trust, which is kind of cool.
It is kind of cool. It's very cool. That's a pretty good book, in fact, and, and has a lot of great points to it. So, definitely Nook and Tomas, Take Me to the Truth, great book.
Yeah.
So, and the other, Nook has The End of Death, which is a book that really delves into, you know, Jesus's discussions about health and healing and the body. And, you know, that's one of the places where I'm seeing that, you know, it's being seen as literal, you know, that the body actually will be healed and you actually will have, perfectly healthy. And I don't, and no one can tell me what that means. Because I keep saying, well, what the heck is a perfectly healthy body? You know, is it possible? Well, no, the body is the home of ego and it's the symbol of death. You know, there's never going to be a perfectly healthy body. But my body is perfectly healthy because I'm sitting here talking with you.
Uh-huh.
I have everything I need and all the extensions of my body and everything that is around me is the perfect thing for me right now. And I think that is, of course, that's my own opinion. I think that's the actual thing that changes is that as your perception changes, you begin to see that everything is perfect just the way it is.
Right.
And you don't have to change the world or any other thing. In order to, you know, accepting the atonement and salvation is it. That's all.
So, yeah, yeah. And at that moment, when we have those little holy instants or epiphanies or whatever we want to call them, miracle moments, we have released our identification with ego and embraced, which is really pretty easy because that's all there is. In truth, we just have to get the illusion out of the way. Yeah, the reality of our being that we all share, and the peace floods in automatically. That's why the third step in forgiveness is just, you know, the replacement is we don't do that. We just get the heck out of the way, and then that happens automatically.
Exactly.
That's really fun.
As you were saying that, you were making me think of the obstacles to peace and how, you know, Jesus talks about peace flowing over, peace flowing. You know, and that's really what happens when we stop resisting is that peace does flow.
Yeah.
It's kind of
like when you take a cup or something in a sink full of soapy water and you push it slowly down into the sink. When the water gets to the rim, it and you push it down below that, the water will flood in to fill it because that's the nature of that substance. It just flows wherever it needs to go to fill in what appears to be, you know, empty space. But we have to make room for it in our minds, and that's always the
you have to have an empty cup.
Yeah. We have to get our self interest, our little seemingly separate self, the little SSS I call it, out of the way.
That's it, exactly. So, shall we go and look at our question for the day?
Yeah. Since we have about a half hour left, why not?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to post again in the room where we're getting this from. How about if I let you read?
Okay. Are we going to do 1299 or 1302?
Okay.
Do you have a preference among those two, or?
You know what? I have 1295.
Oh, okay.
Why do I have that? Let me look.
Oh, okay.
Because I think it's. I thought that was what you had.
They're all good. I think while you weren't available, I posted one in Skype, and that might be what you're seeing.
Okay.
But we could go back to those. I need to go through and post some of the ones that you've sent me links to. So I'm kind of out of sync. I just figure if I keep moving, I won't repeat anything that we might have already covered.
Okay.
which is another reminder that
1299.
Okay. Yeah.
Because now that I'm looking at it, I'm like, yeah, this is it. We need to talk about this.
Yeah. So I need the reminders because I'm becoming more and more cognizant of the resistance in my mind all the time, including and inclusive of the tendency to forget things I've even talked about with you in past Saturday mornings, because, you know, again, it's a thought system that's really challenging, and I think that's why, you know, we're all worthy of such tremendous compassion and patience, because our resistance is so enormous to this material. You know, it's just, it's, to use the adjective of a contemporary politician, it's huge.
Huge.
It's huge. Okay, I'll read the question. This is 1299 from Foundation for A Course in Miracles, Frequently Asked Questions, about, of which there are 1,300 plus, and they're all wonderful, in my estimation. Okay, 1299 starts out, the sections of A Course in Miracles titled The Agreement to Join, which is Chapter 28, Section 3, and The Greater Joining, also in that same Chapter 28, Section 4, seem very important with respect to practically dealing with, quote, others, unquote, and our perceptions of them, and therefore our perceptions of ourselves. However, I am unclear as to the practical application of their meaning. Take, for example, the statement, quote, uniting with a brother's mind prevents the cause of sickness and perceived effects, unquote. Well, I think this addresses the very thing we were just talking about. And that's from section 3 in that same chapter 28. If I see a brother who is sick, in whatever form that may take, I know that I have joined him in that illusion. But what is it that I am to see, look for, become aware of, etc., in order to prove him and myself wrong in this perception? What a great question, huh?
Yeah, it's a perfect question, and it really is exactly kind of what we were just talking about,
mm-hmm.
maybe with a little different nuances.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I've looked at these sections too, about the joining and healing thing. And, you know, I'm seeing that it is, like really important. Jesus talks about it over and over and over and over. And so, you know, why is it not happening? And I'm recognizing because of this actual joining, being something that maybe I'm not so good at, even though I think that that's, you know, what I really want. And yet I see a lot of reasons why it doesn't work. So, you know, this idea of uniting with a brother's mind, preventing the cause of sickness and perceived effects. That's what causes healing.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, that's what Joel Goldsmith did. I think that's how real healers do.
Okay.
Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say that this to me is a perfect example of, again, the non-dual metaphysics of the Course reminding us that the only healing is in the mind, and that is recognizing that there is no separation between self and other, and that those are all just misperceptions that are rooted in the unconscious guilt that perceived the need for making up a world to hide from a separation that never happened in the first place.
Yeah. So, yeah. Simply stated, yes.
Well, maybe not so simply, but hopefully.
Well, no, actually, but it is. This whole idea of perception and what is Lesson 25. Is it lesson 25 that says that? Projection makes perception. Yeah, I don't know if it's in lesson 25, but projection makes perception.
Mm-hmm.
Is the thing that is most important to remember, because all Jesus is telling me is if I see it, it's because I'm making it. I'm projecting it. If I'm seeing it, I'm projecting it. And so this idea of perception of sickness, perception of seeing my brother as being sick, either in the body or the mind, or the, you know, you're not ethical or you're not a good person. All of these ideas that we judge our brother as being something different and separate and unworthy is all a projection from my own thinking. And so that's where it has to come from. It has to come from me. I'm the one who's making that happen.
Exactly.
Which is
that, that, that. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say the quote that you were looking for, projection makes perception, is the very first sentence in chapter 21, Reason and Perception.
Okay.
I seem to recall Ken Wapnick saying that that's a quote appears twice in the course. I'm going to search for it, see if I can find it. Because I think that's twice in the somewhere. But go ahead.
It's so essential to remember that. That if I'm seeing it, and Carrie Triffitt said this, it was so cute. If I'm seeing it on my screen, it must be coming from my projector.
Bingo. Yeah, really.
You know, that's it. I see it on my screen. It's coming from my projector. I don't have to blame anybody else for it.
Yep.
So this is, I think, really what's being talked about here. So I'm going to start reading the answer to the question. And see what kind of clarity the folks at the foundation have. Discussing practical applications of course principles is always tricky. On one hand, the course is very practical because it tells us exactly how to follow its teachings. On the other hand, when most of us think of practical applications, we envision something we can do behaviorally. Okay, that's real important. We think we can do it through behavior, but the course is never about behavior. Thus, to answer your question, there is nothing you are supposed to see, look for, or become aware of externally.
Mm-hmm.
How could there be when the course's overarching message is that there is nothing external to your own mind? And lesson 132 comes to mind. And the course certainly does not ask you to prove your perceptions or those of your brother wrong. So it's not about perception.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the whole, that whole emphasis on being alert to when we want to prove ourselves or someone wrong as being a telltale sign, you know, red flag, you know, idiot light on the dashboard saying alert, alert, alert. You know, that's like, okay, if I'm wanting to go on any kind of vendetta, that's a clue that I'm barking up the wrong tree again and singing from the ego's dirge hymnal. Yeah, I did look up projection makes perception from the Miracle Distribution Center website, which temporarily is the place that has both the text and the manual in addition to the workbook. And I find it easy to search there. And it is in chapter 13 in the Guiltless World section. And it's also in chapter 21, as I pointed out. And it's also actually in the introduction to the course, because it basically is part of, is right in the what it says section. In the preface part of this, the course, which is basically just referring to where it appears further in the course. So there's really two actual references, in, as Ken pointed out, to that. And the meaning for this, of course, the importance of that is it is important to remember that our world, which is a projection, it's what creates our perceptions. It's not the world doing it to us. It's we're seeing a feedback mechanism from the mind, and that changes everything, because then it takes us out of victimhood and puts us back in control of our thinking. And most importantly, the one choice that we really have, which is our choice of teachers, our choice of thought system at any moment.
Exactly. And that doesn't seem like a big deal until you make that choice.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then the choice makes all the difference in the world.
Completely. Yeah. Shall I read the next paragraph?
Go ahead, please.
Okay. What then is it telling us to do? We can begin to answer this by carefully reading the very sentences you referred to. Uniting with a brother's mind, in italics, prevents the cause of sickness and perceived effects. And that's, again, chapter 28 in the text of A Course in Miracles, section 3, paragraph 2, sentence 5, if you want to look up the exact reference. In other words, we are asked to join on the level of mind. Jesus says nothing about joining as bodies or doing anything on the level of form. So here's an example of, you know, if you have a family member that's passed on or a friend or if it's someone who physically you don't have any accessibility to, such as, you know, Lynn and I are in different states talking to each other, but we're joining at a level of mind, and whoever, presumably whoever's listening now could be anywhere on the planet doing the same. You know, it's not about the form, and it's not about even, you know, the sound waves of this conversation. It's a thought that is, you know, as Richard Bach said, you know, a perfect invisible idea everywhere at once, across space and time, or really beyond space and time. And I think that's the essence that we're remembering here, is that we have this perfect oneness that is a whole realm of thinking, the whole thought, complete thought system that is contrary to the thought system of divisiveness and martyrdom and and dis-ease, if you will, that is really all about the mind again. So I'll continue here. Obviously, a body cannot join with a mind. Clearly, this has to mean that the place in which we join our brother is in our thoughts. This prevents the cause of sickness. It does this because the cause of sickness is our belief in guilt and separation. Therefore, by recognizing in our own mind that guilt and separation are illusory, and that we are united with our brother, both in our sense of guilt within this dream and as God's beloved son in reality, we disarm the guilt and fear that caused the need for sickness as a potent defense against the truth within this dream. And as you've pointed out, and many others, it doesn't mean that what we've set in motion on the level of form doesn't play out. For example, if you have a physical ailment or a financial situation or a relationship, struggle, or, you know, whatever it might be, those things may still play out on the level of form. But I think we find we have less and less interest in an adversarial role, less and less interest in wanting to make big deals out of our separate interests and our individual, being right and and, you know, essentially the proving, if you will, which is what this FAQ it talks about, wanting to prove something on the level of form.
Absolutely, and what is so hard here, obviously, is to be able to see my brother sinless, or to see my brother without the guilt that I'm projecting onto him, to see my brother as wholly worthy of forgiveness. These are things that Jesus tells us over and over and over through the course. If we can actually do this, would shift everything, would change everything, would change our entire ability to see the truth and to see and to hear the voice for God. And, you know, I mean, it shifts everything when we do this, but you have to do it. You can't, and you have to do it, unilaterally. I mean, you have to do it for everybody. You can't pick and choose. I know when I first read that section where in chapter 31, I think, where close to the end, where he's saying that if you could just see one brother as wholly worthy of forgiveness, it would change your entire point of view. You would see everything differently. And I thought, well, okay, I could do that. Let me think, who's the most innocent person I can think of? Because if I can find this most innocent person and just look at them and, you know, see them as wholly worthy of forgiveness, boy, that would do it. I'd be the shift, right?
There you go.
So I'm looking at, you know, baby, I'm looking at my little grandson, and actually it was before that, but I, you know, the same kind of thing happening is looking at, you know, someone who is guaranteed to be innocent, and then look at all my thoughts about that person. Look at all my thoughts about, you know, I have all these projections about their life and projections, thoughts about what kind of person and personality they're going to have or they have. You know, thoughts and projections about their health, thoughts and projections about our ability to take care of them. There's all sorts of things, you know, right away I'm beginning to see there's problems with this kid. You know, this is not, You know, I'm looking at the most perfectly innocent person I can think of, and I'm seeing all the objections that I have, all the problems that I have, all the worries and fears that I have. You know, a holy worthy of forgiveness means that I can just let God take care of him. I don't have to be involved in any way at all. I don't have to have an opinion about anything that happens. You know, I can just let him be and trust that, you know, everything is perfect for him. Well, I found that I was not able to do that at all. So then I thought, you know, I was awake in the middle of the night and still looking at, you know, thinking about this and contemplating this. And I said, Holy Spirit, help me to see, you know, is there any, how can I see anyone wholly worthy of forgiveness? And I looked over at my husband who was sleeping and I was like, oh no, please, please don't. Please don't make me have to, you know, like really literally look at and forgive him completely.
No, not that.
No, because I'll be here for the rest of my life looking at this person and thinking of all the things that I blame them for. We've been together for, like, since 1974, we've been together.
Wow.
So imagine all the guilt that I've assigned to this person. And I said, no, please, you know, I don't have time for this. And, but then I was actually shown, and it was like a vision. And I saw him. He was laying there sleeping like an innocent baby. And, I saw him, and it was like the layers of crap. I mean, it was like layers of crap. Falling from him. It was like he was encrusted, or like he was in a cocoon or something. And all this crap just was falling. And all the guilt, all the assignment of evil that I had given him for, you know, blaming him for all kinds of things that happened or didn't happen in my life. And began to see, you know, that his gentleness, which I had always known, his sweetness, his kindness, and the real being, the real person that he is, underneath all that crap that I had assigned to him. And it didn't take forever. It took like, you know, I don't even know the time, because it was like just a willingness to let that all go, allowed that all to just drop from my eyes. And again, I saw him as the sweet and innocent being that I first knew when I met him, that I didn't know anything about him. You know, it was like a stranger. It was somebody I never saw before, but I saw the perfect innocence of that being. Mm-hmm. And it did shift me. It shifted me tremendously, and it shifted my relationship with him to a point where I can't even describe what this relationship is now. It's not like, oh, the sweeping grand romance or anything of that nature. It is just perfect love and joy of being with a person who is so wonderful. And, you know, even if he does things that, you know, other people might think are, you know, not kind or nice or whatever to me, I don't notice it because I don't see that. All I see is just love from him, and it's the greatest gift I've ever been given. So, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, run off, you know, belabor all this point. It's this idea of willingness.
Yes.
To see my brother sinless.
That's it. That's
willingness it. To see the innocence.
Yeah, I was just reflecting on, as you were talking, I'm going to paraphrase something that Gary Renard has said in one of his books and certainly audio programs, is that, you know, a holy relationship or a successful relationship is one that is used for forgiveness, which is to say that, just like what you're talking about, Lynn, is if we can remember that any person in our lives, whether it's somebody we just, you know, meet one time in a, you know, passing each other on the aisles in a hardware store or on a highway, you know, going the opposite directions, or someone that's a lifelong partner or family member or, you know, colleague, whatever. It doesn't matter. Those relationships, when we're using those for forgiveness, for healing our mind of the belief in separation, that is a holy relationship. That is a successful relationship. And in the terms of the Course. So, cause that's really when we're seeing that, you know, as you pointed out, and just to see the pure innocence in someone else, that in truth, and it doesn't mean that you don't acknowledge the behavior or the form or the so-called history of another person, or group of persons. It just means that you are willing to see through and beyond that to the reality, and that becomes what you would want to see. You know, that this should be your choice, as the Course puts it, to see our brother's sinlessness. And that's huge, isn't it? That's really an enormous breakthrough when we have those little epiphanies and realize that wanting to see that is truly wanting to see it in ourselves, and that's oftentimes when ego gets very retaliative, because and oftentimes it can take the form of, you know, very quickly having our mind shift to something that we're annoyed with, because on some level I think, you know, we recognize that if we sustain that awareness, we're going home, you know. And
exactly.
But as Ken and many other Course teachers point out, you know, we don't have to worry about, you know, being abruptly hurled into heaven. You know, I think most of us are likely to have, you know, a fairly significant curriculum ahead of us. You know, if we're honest, we're, you know, aspiring to nursery school or kindergarten level curriculum in this metaphysical study, and we're nowhere near a PhD level. and there's nothing wrong with that. And I think there's actually a real promise and it can be an enthusiasm realizing how much more that we have to experience in terms of the peace that will allow us to accept that inclusive comfort more gracefully and more fully, and in a way that we won't want to backslide, that we won't want to, you know, slum around in the ego thinking at some point and say, oh yeah, I'd much rather see this person, you know, as my victimizer or as guilty, because it just no longer has any appeal for us. You know, the seduction of that's gone.
Exactly. And in fact, it becomes painful. You know,
as
you look back and you think any time you start with that, it hurts. So, mm-hmm. you know right away, Jesus tells you, how do you know if you're doing it or not, doing it right or not? How do you feel?
Bingo.
You know, that's what we need to be paying attention to, these feelings. And this is something that in our society and our culture, we've been pretty much trained to only have certain kinds of feelings and certain kinds of emotions. And so the feeling of fear or abandonment or guilt or whatever comes about when we think about rejecting our brother, we perceive that as being something entirely different. We think that it's coming from them, and we blame them. Mm-hmm. You know, you make me feel bad. You make me mad. You hurt my feelings. you're scaring me.
Yeah. You know, I think I might have mentioned this, but years ago, before I even, I think it was probably around the time I was hearing about A Course in Miracles in the, you know, kind of late 70s. I think I kind of knew that there were these binders that were circulating around, but, and then, and then within that time frame, maybe it was into the, might have been, yeah, actually it might have been into the early 80s yeah, I think it was, because I think that was about the time I had moved to, anyway, in late 70s, early 80s, anyway, somewhere in that time frame, my first wife and I, we're studying metaphysical things, and in a group we were in, and we put together a cassette tape, so I'm obviously dating myself, of little snippets of song lyrics that were all based on ego thinking, and we called it the I'm Not Responsible tape, which was basically using as a kind of a highlight the lyric from a Tom Jones album that my wife Chris at the time had, and the whole melody was, I'm not responsible for anything I do when I'm with you, kind of thing. You know? this was taken from a lot of the favorite music of ours, but the song lyrics that were basically blatantly, and sometimes some not so much so, you know, glorifying and rhapsodizing about the ego thought system. And it was just kind of an interesting, you know, precursor to, you know, looking more thoroughly at the contents of the mind. And there may be in a box in my mom's attic somewhere, I think. but anyway, we called it the I'm Not Responsible tape. And it was pretty revealing to just listen to those lyrics and realize how much in our culture we glamorize and rhapsodize and glorify, you know, this idea of being at the mercy of someone else or something else. And it kind of reminds me of an episode of Merv Griffin when Maharishi Mahesh Yogi is talking about, this was decades ago, you know, a political situation that everybody was all upset about and up in arms about. And after the audience was ranting and raving for a while, you know, Merv Griffin asked the Maharishi, you know, what he thought. He says, well, of course, these are only reflections of your thinking. And I'm paraphrasing this greatly. And then the audience was dumbstruck. And they were just like, what?
You're blaming me?
How dare you suggest that these are my projections, you know, kind of thing. But, you know, but that's the last thing that we usually want to look at is, oh, this is what I'm experiencing is a reflection of what's going on in my mind. But that's really the only way out of the quagmire, isn't it?
It is. It's the only way out. And if you're not willing to take that way out, you're going to wander in the quagmire.
Yeah.
So, you know, and one of the things that, the oneness processes that I go through, we've been doing a lot of emphasis on courage and, not recognizing how often we choose to wiggle out of things and not be courageous. It takes courage to look at yourself and look at your mind and look at your thinking.
Yes.
And to take responsibility for the things that you're seeing, and to stop blaming others for or blaming the world or your condition or your body for the thoughts in your mind. Because it's just the opposite. It's the thoughts in your mind that are making you either be in joy or suffer. Mm-hmm. And so it takes great courage to look at your own self and to take responsibility for your own thoughts and to not be blaming other people. Otherwise, you'll never, ever, ever come out of the quagmire.
Uh-huh.
Just be wandering in that, what do they call it? What is it in The Princess Bride? I forget. Anyway, it's a pretty bad place where there's rodents of unusual size.
I remember that. I actually watched that movie a year or two ago, and I forgot that little portion.
Yeah.
In fact, it's actually recorded on our DVR because my wife hadn't seen it for a long time, so we might actually watch that again. But but in any great epic, even or and parodies of the same, you know, can be reminders of you know, that we really are, you know, asked to put away our own heroism in favor of the real hero, which is that inner kindness teacher that vanquishes the foe of duality, and it does it without lifting so much as a feather, let alone a sword, or even a pen, by just recognizing that what is not true has had no effects on truth, and that's a pretty simple thing, but we sure have an enormous resistance to it. Do you want to read the next paragraph?
I'll read the next paragraph. Okay.
Okay.
Because we got 10 minutes left. And I see Devin is here. So,
okay.
So we're talking about uniting with a brother's mind, preventing the cause of sickness and perceived effects. So we're talking about healing, actually. And, so this does not mean that our internal shift will heal either our brother's body or our own. However, it does mean that if we fully made this shift, we could have a body filled with cancer and still be at peace. In fact, not even give a crap about it, not want to go to the doctor, not want to go to chemo. We don't care, right? Because it's the body. It has nothing to do with what I am. Likewise, we could be with a brother who is dying of cancer and know that the disease has no effect on the reality of who he is. From that place, we would see that while his body appears to be sick, he is not a body, and therefore he is not sick. behaviorally, we would probably still do all the loving things one normally does for another who is experiencing pain. We would not try to make the sickness go away or tell the person that it was illusory. If the person were ready to accept that, he would not be sick. For this reason, we would instead comfort the person in whatever way would be most helpful to him in the moment. So this is, you know, the discussion about behavior. What do we do when we are people they have
stuff,
yeah, whatever. And so, you know, instead of falling into that trap of feeling guilty, because when I'm with someone who's sick, I feel guilty that I'm not sick. If I'm with someone who is having extreme mental torture, I feel guilty because I'm not having that. Not, you know, I don't even understand their problem. You know, these are the things that could cause us to lose compassion and be unable to actually be helpful to people. So Jesus is not saying don't be compassionate. Jesus is not saying don't be loving. Jesus is not saying tell your brother that his sickness is an illusion. Jesus is saying to us, be loving, be compassionate, recognize that he is in a place where he can't see his own healing. And Jesus also tells us that we have the capacity of charity to be able to look at that brother and see him as being far beyond where he appears to be at this moment, and to see that he is incapable at this moment of accepting the atonement for himself, and therefore we can accept it for him. This is what happens when the mind is healed. Is instead of wallowing around with people who are suffering and saying, oh, isn't this terrible? We are now in a position as miracle workers to look and see the truth about what's happening here, to see that the person is in fear, to address that fear, address that guilt, because the fear itself, and I've seen this with my daughter here just recently, she's been so, so very sick, and this last time it was really not a good episode with her, and she kept saying, I feel so guilty. I feel so horrible and guilty that I'm putting you all through this terrible thing. And, you know, and it just struck me, oh my God, you know, this is what happens. You know, I don't want to tell people when I'm feeling bad because I feel guilty. You know, I feel like, you know, I'm doing something wrong. I did something wrong. And I did. Having a body was not the right thing to do. And, you know, thinking that I was separate from God was not the right thing to do. Sure.
What was I thinking?
But the idea of that guilt and that fear that that person is suffering, we can help with that by offering them a miracle. Not by saying, oh, you poor thing, and jumping into the pit and wallowing around in suffering, but to just offer them the miracle and know that, you know, that that's not what they are. Yeah. And seeing beyond that, that place. And it does bring about healing. And you know, but of course the person has to be willing to accept the healing too.
Sure,
and they may be so fearful that they can't accept the healing.
But the demonstration of kindness is the real healing, because
yes,
it is the application of the course's curriculum, which is the sole, not the primary, but the sole responsibility of the miracle worker is to accept the atonement for himself or herself. And that's really the reminder that it's only my mind that needs to be healed. And if I can keep that in my mind, I won't believe that I need to fix anything out in the dream. And then that will actually enable me, almost ironically, to actually be more helpful, because I'm not obsessed with thinking that there's something wrong in the world that I need to fix, and that I have actually more options availability to do things in the world behaviorally if necessary that can be helpful.
Exactly, because you're not paralyzed by the fear.
Yeah.
Success or failure.
Yeah.
No outcome. Okay, go ahead and read.
I was just going to say, I'll read the next paragraph if you want.
Yes, please.
another key to grasping what the Course is getting at in the sections you mentioned is the realization that when Jesus talks about sickness, he does not mean a physical ailment in the body. To Jesus, simply thinking that we are here is sick. Bingo again. Yeah. Believing that we need to breathe, eat, sleep, and so forth is an illness, not because these things are bad, but because they represent our clearly insane choice to believe that we could be limited by this, quote, wall of flesh around the mind, keeping it prisoner in a tiny spot of space and time, beholden unto death, and given but an instant in which to sigh and grieve and die. Chapter 20, section 4. Paragraph 11. From Jesus' healed perspective, then, your need to breathe is no more or less a sickness than your brother's cancer. Bingo again. This is why accepting the atonement for yourself means not to give support to someone's dream of sickness and of death. Chapter 28, section 4, paragraph 1. Accepting the atonement means recognizing that the entirety of our experience is but a bad dream of sickness and of death. And this is true whether the body currently appears to be what the world would label as healthy or ill. So, wow, a lot there, huh?
Yeah, that, I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
Right there, that's it. It's this whole thing of thought. And, this whole idea of appearances that, we just get caught up in and buy into. So accepting the atonement for yourself means not to give support to someone's dream of sickness and death. Again, it doesn't mean go to your friend and say, I don't believe you're sick. So, you know, even if you die, it's not really dead and you are, you know, this is all an illusion and a dream. You don't do that. You do that to your own self. You say to your own mind, you know, I believe that this person is sick. I believe that this person is going to die. That is obviously a mistaken belief. And I want that belief to be corrected and to no longer be looking at this person as if they are sick and going to die, but be looking at them as if they are the Christ, whole, healed, and innocent. All is forgiven and released. Boom.
Yes.
That's it. And believe me, I use that mantra a lot.
It's a good one. It's a good one. Do you want to finish the last sentence or last paragraph?
Sure, sure. Okay, fortunately, Jesus does not ask us to make this dramatic shift in our thinking on our own. He lets us know that the Holy Spirit is already in our mind, ready to help us change our thoughts whenever we ask him to. Again, you do not have to look for or prove anything. Your willingness to let illusions go is all the healer of God's Son requires. Again, from chapter 28.
Wow.
So there you go.
Nice wrap up, huh?
Let illusions go. That's it.
Just let them go.
Are you willing to see what you denied because it was the truth? Yeah.
Yeah.
Last unanswered question.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.
I always enjoy these conversations. It's helpful to me because I remind myself of stuff I need to remember in the undo process.
Oh, me too. And it gets my weekend off to a real roar, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
So.
And thank you all for participating.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you all for participating. And remember, for me, the Weekend of Freedom Retreat coming up October 5th through the 8th.
Right.
In just outside of Boone, North Carolina, the Art of Living Retreat is an incredible, beautiful place, and the Weekend of Freedom Retreat is the name of our retreat there. You know, let me know, or if it's www.weekendoffreedomretreat.org. I think is it .org.
Anyway, I think we have .com and .org registered for that domain.
Uh-huh. All right, but anyway, check it out I'd love to see you. And then, of course, there are several other wonderful things coming up over the next few months. But now it's time to let go of the mic and turn over to Devin and hopefully Barb. So I love you guys. Thank you, Bruce. See you next
week. Likewise.
All righty. Bye-bye.